today is the second week, and I think we're getting toward the end of our fall fun drive, and it's time to give a call, 505-428-1393, 428-1393, and it's the time where if you have been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe for any amount of time at all, and you keep tuning in, then support that with a call. And a call to this radio station ensures that we stay on the air. 428-1393. And I would like to introduce a wonderful author named Craig Childs. He's the author of many books, and his newest book is called Apocalyptic Planet. He will be at the Hotel Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock giving a lecture for the Southwest Seminar Series, which is co-sponsored by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So this book covers some of the most rapidly changing places in the world, and your chapters have titles like Deserts Consume, Ice Collapses, Seas Rise, Civilizations Fall. Tell us how you got the idea to write this book.
Well, I think it comes out of my fascination for desolate landscapes, just exposed places. Where I've always traveled in these areas that are just raw, elemental, and that kind of led to these questions of what does this mean when something gets reduced, when an environment changes, when you end up with a desert where there wasn't a desert before, and also in the Colorado Plateau, where you're looking at all these layers of rock, you're seeing time around you. You have a really different sense of time out here.
And that's where you live.
Right. Not terribly far from here.
Yeah.
Just north of here. And this is a landscape that tells these stories about changes in the Earth's history. And so I wanted to go out into the rest of the world and see how that story plays out. I wanted to go to more severe places than where I usually travel and see what story is being told by the Earth about its past, about the future. And you know, in some ways, I wanted to fight against this notion that we have of apocalypse being a sudden moment of endings. I wanted to tell a story about the more cyclical, continuous world we live in, and the dangerous world we live in. What can go wrong? What can change rapidly? You know, how fragile is this planet? What is the context of climate change? I took on a lot of big questions in this book.
Indeed. I mean, the subtitle is Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, and it's one of those books that has, at least for me, the power to change my sense of perspective and my sense of time on the Earth we're living in, because the idea, and I don't know what it is about our culture that we feel that we have a birthright to stability.
Right.
But we don't, because it ain't there.
Yeah, and that's a lot of where I want to go with this, is saying that yeah, this world is beautiful that we live in right now. It's an awesome place, but there is no guarantee that it will last the way it is now. In fact, the chances of it lasting are very slim, and it's easy to push this planet into a different equilibrium, or to push parts of the planet into some other state. And so I'm going back through Earth's history, through, you know, over 4 billion years of geologic history, and saying, what kind of Earth has existed before? What different faces does this planet show? And each one of the landscapes in this book is one of those faces. So, this birthright for stability, I can understand it. I mean, we certainly...
It's nice.
We want it to stay. We want it to be this way. But you have to fight to keep it this way. It is work, and we are working the opposite direction. We are pushing on it to change, not to remain the same. So we're moving toward instability.
Now, you start the first chapter, Deserts Consume, is about the Sonoran Desert, and you go out into this place. I mean, I'm reading this thing thinking, I'm so glad I'm sitting here on a couch and that you were the one who went out there. But, I mean, this is a place that you describe as being almost strangely peaceful because there's almost no life. I mean, you come across a few sand crickets and a scorpion, but basically, except for you guys, everything that could have died has already done so.
Right. Yeah, we were in a sand dune sea in Sonora that extends probably about 3,000 square miles. And we were there on the seventh year of a deep drought, so life had just been erased from the place, which for us was actually perfect. It's what we were looking for. We wanted to see this kind of sere, exposed region. And for me, it is just the most beautiful place that I can imagine. It's one of my favorite places in the world, where I've gone back numerous times and trekked across it. Just, it's 400, 500, 800 foot tall dunes that are just sweeping over each other, and there are places where you're in the middle of it and you see nothing but sand as far as you can see, and it's just so elegant, so beautiful. All the greenery of the world has been reduced to this butterscotch colored sand that is really fine. It's like flour. It's like walking through silk, and we traveled barefoot for weeks out there, just carrying water to get as much water into the middle of it as possible, and then you can just hang out there for as long as you want.
And you went with a friend who you trek with quite often.
Right. I tend to go out with the same people over and over again. We're familiar with each other. We don't worry about each other. We just, you have a way of traveling with people like that where you may not be within visual range of that person, but you know where he is, and you know that by the end of the day you're going to find each other again, no matter how complex the topography.
And so when you are out in a landscape like this, you find very, very old things.
Yeah. We came across something that was just amazing that I hadn't expected at all. We started finding bones out there that were unusually large, like deer bones, but it didn't make sense. They were partly fossilized. They were kind of like glass, and then my friend Devin found the source of them. He found this pit in the sand, maybe a baseball field sized pit that the wind had blown out and exposed thousands of these semi fossilized bones. I imagine they're from the Pleistocene. From a water hole that must have been there, a huge water hole that dried up. And so there are camel bones, bison, large predator, probably bears, probably even large, like American lion, some kind of large extinct cat. And just everywhere, the place was carpeted with these bones, mice, birds. And so you could see this ending. You could see, this was like a big African savanna-style waterhole that was out here that dried up, and everything that was here died. There was no escape for them. And then you're looking down through it where the wind has exposed layers, and you can see that this has happened multiple times, that this waterhole then came back. Everything came here and survived, and then the waterhole dried up, and everything died. And so you're seeing these layers of catastrophe that happened in the past, and you're walking across sand now. We're now in the time in between, when the water's gone, and so you get this sense of time that goes beyond our daily time or our decades or centuries. You're starting to look into thousands of years and see these processes rolling in and out of each other.
I often think of the water hole where when it dries up, everything around it dies as a metaphor for petroleum-based culture.
Right. Yeah, and you just hope that you're not one of those that are clinging desperately to the dwindling supply, because no doubt a lot of animals left. The bones I'm seeing are just the ones who, by the time they realized what was going on, it was too late.
Right.
And I think it is the same way. We definitely have an infrastructure to soften the blow, but it depends on how fast. And that's a lot of the question in this book is the speed of these events. If they happen fast, it's cataclysm.
Right.
If they happen over decades, centuries, then you just adjust as it happens and you don't even see it happening, which I think is mostly the case. It's very rare in human history and global history that something really dramatic happens all of a sudden and everything changes and death across the board. It tends to be more of a mosaic of it tends to be regional, and it's heading in a direction over centuries, over thousands of years. I mean, you look at mass extinctions in the past, and they didn't happen at once. The dinosaur extinction probably wasn't an overnight thing. It probably took hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions, to play out.
We're talking to author Craig Childs about his book, Apocalyptic Planet, and we're going to take just a little break right now to let people know that it is time to give a call to 505-428-1393, and the publisher of this book has very generously given us 10 copies of the book. So if you would like one of those 10 copies, I'm not sure if any are gone yet, but if you would like it, go for it. Give us a call, 505-428-1393. You can also call the toll-free number, which is 1-866-907-5737, 866-907-5737, and give a call. Now, Craig, do you do a lot of public radio shows?
Oh, yeah. I am a commentator for Morning Edition, and I've got a radio station. I live near Paonia, Colorado, on the Western Slope, and there's a local radio station there. I DJ'd there back in the late 80s, and I'm always in that station. We're always doing things. I'm heavily involved with it.
So why should people call and make a pledge to KSFR right now?
Because the world might end if they don't. it's interesting. I feel like one of my conclusions in this book is that to keep the world as it is, you really have to work at it. You can't just let it do its own thing. I mean, you can, and you can hope for the best. But there's so many forces working against the beautiful world that we know now. And I think, you know, this is one of the things. Civilization, it's held up by things like public radio, libraries, you know, institutions that we share. And they could easily start draining away over time. I mean, we're watching cuts after cuts after cuts. Like, there's a certain element of the world that is working against stuff like this.
Yeah.
And if you want the world that we're in now to continue, you fight for it in whatever way you can. And, you know, keeping public radio going, I know it may sound strange to relate this to apocalypse, but I see ends as happening in all sorts of different scales. And
yeah.
If I see a public radio station go down, I just go, oh, I know where that goes. I know where the burning of libraries takes you.
You have to
put your shoulder behind these things and keep them moving. So
505-428-1393, 428-1393. Yeah, when they start burning libraries, it's a very bad sign.
Yeah. Whenever you see that, it just means things are going downhill. It's going to take a while to recover from this.
One of the things that I appreciate about the book, and ladies and gentlemen, you can get a copy of the book once again, Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, is that you use throughout the book similes when you're describing nature that come from civilization. Like,
yeah.
You're lying on some horrible rugged ground, and you said it's like lying on a floor full of toys. Or you're looking at a glacier collapse and you say that piece was as tall as a two-story building or something like that. And it's like, I thought it was such a beautiful and subtle way of saying I love civilization.
Yeah.
To compare nature to it. Usually it's the other way around. We compare human things to natural things.
Yeah. I think a lot of, you know, people who write in the natural world or just seek the natural world are kind of repulsed by civilization. But I think we've done an amazing thing here. I'm just grateful for the fact that we are able to have something decent going on in this world. I know that humanity can be just this horrible, nasty thing, but we also do just beautiful stuff. I mean, the food, the music, the love, the family, there's so much about civilization. I love coming into a city, you know, coming here into Santa Fe is just this, it's a free-for-all for me where I just go, all right, there are stores and cars and things are moving. I love riding in urban environments. you know, I write a lot in the field, in the wilderness, but when I'm actually writing a book and taking things out of my journal, I like to be in active places. You know, like this cafe would be a great place to write.
Do you write in coffee shops?
Yeah, yeah, where there's energy going on around me, and I kind of draw off that energy and respond to it. So I think civilization is a marvelous thing. I don't think we're the cancer on the planet that a lot of people say we are. I mean, yes, we do a fair bit of damage.
Well, we do a fair bit of damage, and one of the things is, I mean, when you're talking about the desert and you talk about the advancing desert, how much is advanced? Like, what are we talking about? I mean, part of the narrative of this book is not only your experience in the field, but it's really interwoven with kind of scientific and journalistic reporting. And what's happening in terms of the deserts on this planet?
Well, there is a big shift that's happening right now that's very easy to identify, and it's the circulation patterns in the atmosphere that form deserts around the globe. And those, they tend to stay fairly stable over the last 40,000 years. They really haven't moved that much. But over the last 20 years, these circulation patterns have moved north by 2 to 3 degrees of latitude, which is just huge, which means the potential for desert has expanded by 3 degrees of latitude around the world. And that's
a lot of land.
Yeah, that is a lot of land. And that means that you know, it's not that land sinks directly into desert. It means that it becomes more marginal. It becomes unstable. That it can more easily become arid. And you're seeing it around the planet. You're seeing, you know, dust storms increasing. Just where I live in western Colorado, we've had for the last 4 years these spring dust storms blowing in out of Utah, which are very unusual. They're just these deep red storms where it starts raining and it's like raining blood. It's mud is coming out of the sky, and it coats the mountains with this red dust. So in the spring, you know, all of southwest Colorado, western Colorado, the snow is not white anymore. It's red. And what happens there is that causes the snowpack to melt much faster. So we're losing our snowpack a month earlier every summer because of these storms.
Because the red absorbs the heat of the sun.
Right, right. And then we're losing our summer snowpack, and irrigation ditches are going dry a month earlier than they used to. So things are drying out. And this is how deserts spread. It's not, you know, in some places it is a wall. It is a moving sand dune. But in most places it's like this. It's season by season. A place that isn't arid starts deteriorating and starts becoming arid, and that's how you see it changing. So it takes a while for it to happen, but not that long. I mean, you can watch it over a period of years, and we're seeing it happen around the planet. I'm seeing it happen at where I live right now.
And this is arable land becoming non-arable land,
right?
Which has huge implications for the food supply in a continually burgeoning population.
Oh yeah, the droughts this summer in the Midwest. I mean, we don't look at that as desert, but you know, I go down through the record. I look at how what the Midwest has been like over the last 10,000 years, and I realize, the largest sand dune sea in the Americas or in North America is actually in Nebraska. You know, the largest sand desert is in the
amazing.
In the high plains.
Right.
It's just covered with grass right now. But that grass can dwindle and the desert can unleash. And it has happened a number of times over the last few thousand years.
We're talking to Craig Childs about his wonderful book, Apocalyptic Planet. And lest you think, ladies and gentlemen, that it's a downer to read. I mean, it's not light and fluffy, everything is great. But it's so beautifully written and it's just so fascinating. And it's not just like, oh, nature is good and we're bad, as you say. It's really just an exploration of this whole beautiful, crazy, violent planet.
Yeah, yeah. And I felt like we needed a beautiful book on apocalypse. And we needed a book that looked apocalypse in the eye, that said, okay, this is what it is. Just straight on. Just let's not put judgment on anthropogenic changes. Let's not, you know, we can look at culpability and how we're changing the planet, But let's just lay it out there in context. Just say, how does this fit into the last few million years of climate changes? You know, where are we right now? What's happening in this world?
We are, in terms of our fund drive, we are 20% of the way to our goal for this morning. We have a $1,200 goal, and a couple of people have taken the books. Keep calling, ladies and gentlemen, please. 505-428-1393. 428-1393. 428-1393. And you can get a copy of this wonderful book by Craig Childs. And it's a book that you basically made from your field notes, which you take copious notes when you're out in the field.
Yeah.
Just in what? Just a regular notebook with a pen?
Yeah, I carry around a little palm-sized notebook that I have in my pocket, so I'm always pulling it out and writing every detail as I pass it. Just the direction the wind is coming from, what does live lava sound like as it's flowing across rock?
What does live lava sound like when it's flowing across rock?
Well, it's hissing and popping. it sounds like, I guess at one point I described it as a heap of scrap metal being dragged across a car hood. So you're hearing all these, metallic sounds and then all these bubbles popping and hissing it's a very loud sound. You know, there are a lot of, I thought ice being on the top of a glacier would be very quiet, and it turned out to be just rumbling. You could hear these rivers being born underneath you and waterfalls, you know, melt water coming off the top and plunging into holes, and you're listening to it echoing as it's disappearing down into these blue holes under your feet. There's so much sensual detail in these landscapes. I guess there is everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But out there, it's just expressed in this extraordinary way. It's a great place to write, because there's so much happening around you all the time.
We're talking to Craig Childs. It's primal. And, I mean, when lava moving across rock, climate change didn't do that, right?
Right.
But glaciers melting, climate change did do that. And so
yeah.
You're out in Patagonia, Chile. You worked on what I think you called it a Save the Earth documentary.
Yeah.
And you hear and see these glaciers just falling apart, and what land looks like when the ice disappears.
Yeah, and we're there right as the glaciers are retreating, one of the fastest retreats in the world. And it's so fast that the ground is still dewatering from the glacier that was there. And the, you know, no grass has grown back in. You know, the glacier was there a year before, and now, you know, these splintering pieces of ice are left, and these chunks are just left sitting out in the sand. And we'd actually come over this pass, and there had been a lake, a 200-foot deep lake that was there 2 weeks before.
Right.
And it's gone. It's just, this landscape is changing so rapidly, and it's just booming all the time, because big chunks, these big glacial seracs, are falling off and crashing into the valley. And so it's a place that's in constant motion. There is just, it's amazing to be there at that moment. You know, glacial advances are much slower, and I've talked to people who've watched them, who've seen glaciers move through forests and push down trees. And still they say it's nothing compared to watching the retreat. You know, as it's melting, as the water is coming off, it's geologic mayhem. Everything's going on around you.
I remember being in Alaska in the mid-1980s and reading the local paper, and it said, the headline on the front page one day was, "Glacier Moves 1 Inch." And back in those days, that was big news.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now it's...
Oh, yeah, now by the end of the summer, it's retreated by 2 miles. You know, and then next year it's 4 miles back. I talked to gauchos who grew up in this valley, and they said, "Oh, there was this big wall of ice here, and we pastured up to the ice, and now the valley has no ice in it. The glacier has pulled back over the pass and is in the next valley over." So you're talking a retreat there of like 12 miles. in our lifetime.
What was that documentary about? Did it come out?
It did. It actually traveled pretty well on the mountain film circuit. We were trying to stop a series of dams from being built on this remote river in Patagonia, and our trip was crossing the glaciers at the foot of the Patagonian ice cap, the northern Patagonian ice cap, and then running this river from source to sea, from ice about 200 miles down to the fjords, you know, we were part of a lot of effort to stop these dams. So far, we haven't been successful. The dams haven't been built yet, but the government is okaying their construction. So things aren't looking good. But it was also hard to be down there saying, hey, we're from the United States where we dammed up every river and we have profited insanely from our exploits and we don't think you should do the same.
Right. It was a U.S.-made documentary?
Yeah. It was a bunch of people from Flagstaff, pretty much, and passionately trying to save this river from huge hydroelectric projects, because it's not just about the river down there, it's about the whole region. This is an amazingly pristine part of the world and one of the last temperate zones of its size that isn't heavily inhabited. And so we're down there talking to people, just going, just so you know what you have, this is the last of the last on the planet. And if these dams happen, you know, this is going to be the center of an energy production region for the country, and this is going to be heavily industrialized. It's really going to change Patagonia. So I didn't feel like we were there to stop the dams. We were there to tell them, you guys are on the leading edge of history right now, and you could change things. You could go a different direction, because, you know, if these dams come, this place is going to be over. And yeah, sure, that happens, and you'll go on living happily ever after, but this planet will be knocked back a notch. You know, this region will be radically changed.
Do you consider yourself an activist against climate change, environmentalist?
Yeah, I do. I feel like this book is a call to action. I tried to make it a somewhat subtle call. I didn't want to. I feel like the books they're just banging people over the heads with a sledgehammer, which, you know, needs to happen, but people aren't listening.
Doesn't always
anymore.
Work.
So I'm trying to just come in and say, well, you decide for yourself whether you want to be an activist or not. Here are the facts. Here's what's happening on this planet. Personally, I think we're facing the largest change humanity has seen, at least civilized humanity. We are seeing major changes that are primarily coming from us, and I'm at this point saying, okay, this is going to be a moment in geologic history that will really stand out. This is going to be one of those big extinctions. I mean, we're already into it. We can see that we're in a mass extinction, which is rare in Earth's history, and it's happening now primarily because of human alteration of habitat, fragmenting habitats, and introducing non-native species. So I feel like we need to know where we are and what we're doing right here and how we can change it. And I'm not shouting it in this book. I'm talking to, you know, one of the head authors for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We were in a tent together on the Greenland ice sheet for a long time, and I'm just asking him, and it's just one sentence, so what's the best thing we could do? And he says, you know, everything considered, the best thing we can do right now is get clean energy, clean, efficient energy to developing nations. That's going to be where the major source of chemical imbalance, atmospheric imbalance, is going to come from over the next century.
You mean like hydroelectric power?
No, not even hydroelectric, because that's not even. But that's the issue.
That's what I'm saying.
That I had to deal with that down in Chile, where I was going, okay, well, do we tell you not to build these dams and you build more coal-fired power plants? Is that how this works? You know,
right.
But he's saying, there are efficient, you know, solar, wind. There are far more efficient projects, because even building a hydro dam is a huge carbon footprint. It may not. You may see that we've got energy coming from it that's somewhat renewable, but the the amount of energy that goes into making it, that goes into the power line, that just promotes further industrial growth, you know, that's gonna change the atmosphere even more.
The number is 505-428-1393. I'm getting a message that the phones have been a little bit quiet this morning, and we've gotten some calls and some people have taken the books, but we would like to get all 10 books out into your lovely hands so that you can read this book as I did yesterday, a wonderful book by Craig Childs, Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393, and maybe we can get a little report from the control room. How are things going?
Well, we're moving along, Mary Charlotte. Guess what? We have some thank yous here.
Yay.
Claire Gippo, she renewed her sustaining membership.
Oh, how wonderful. Thank you.
And Roberta Yasuda, we've heard that name before during this fun drive.
Thank you so much.
Roberta. And then a high school classmate of yours called from Ipswich, Massachusetts.
Good heavens, who was that?
Mary Kriegbaum.
Oh, how wonderful. She was one of my very best friends in high school. Good heavens. Hi. 428-1393 is the number, and let's keep it going. Let's keep the fun drive going. Let's keep this show going. Let's keep it on the radio. 428-1393. We have a $1,200 goal for the day. We're not even halfway there for the morning, I mean, just by the end of the news at 9 today. And since it's about 20 of 9, let's crank it up and give a call right now. 428-1393. And you can get a copy of the book. And above all, you can support this show. I find it always a little bit, I don't know, like, sometimes people say, oh, I listen to your show every day, and then the fun drive comes on and they don't call. And that seems, I don't like it.
Yeah, you got to keep this thing moving.
Yeah.
It takes some effort.
428-1393. And, I mean, one of the things I liked about that chapter that takes place in Patagonia, Chile, where you're watching and listening to glaciers fall apart, and you're going to places where there was a lake and the lake just isn't there anymore. It must have had a crack and all the water just drained out. Is that you also describe the crew and the people who you were with and just the kind of social aspect of being on a film crew there, and some, you know, total daredevils jumping from one ice chunk to another and looking at the lake and say, let's make the world's biggest martini.
Right. It was a crazy group of folks, which is, you know, that always adds to the story when you're out there, you know, with a horse train following you, just loaded down with rum, and you're crusading off into the wilderness to make a film. And, you know, I'm not used to being followed around by cameras, so I'm hiding from the camera. I'm dropping down into these gullies so they can't find me.
Right.
But I'm kind of the presenter in the show, so they're always looking for me. You know, and it's the characters who for me bring it back to a very human level, because I want to say it's not just this big stuff that's going on around us. It's also human life that in one sense I'm explaining in this book that the world lives on, that we're not going to destroy the earth. The earth recovers, it changes, it and it's always changing. It's always going through various catastrophes, but you can take that point of view and just say it's all going to be fine. But you look back at our lives, you look at our time here and say, well, actually it's not all going to be fine. We're seeing massive loss and massive change right now, and I want to keep this human scale going through this whole book so that we know it's not just about the long geologic story, it's also about the length of our lives.
Well, your chapter Civilization's Fall is set in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
Why Phoenix?
I thought there's no better city in the world to write about the rise and fall, and it's got the name. I mean,
right?
You can't lose with a name like Phoenix. That's a question I ask in this chapter: is did they know what they were getting into when they named it Phoenix? That yes, you know, Phoenix rose up on the ruins of the Hohokam civilization that was there before, and Anglo settlers were saying, we are rising up from the ashes. We are the next bird. But I'm saying, don't you realize that this thing is cyclic? That this story is about the bird rises up and then lights on fire and turns into ashes, and then the next one comes. That you have named this city after a process of destruction and rebirth. And it's a perfect city for that, because you look down at it and you can see that it doesn't have a center. It's sprawled out all over the place, but that's because it's on a hydraulic network that is not a centralized network. It's on a headgate network, which is the same network that was there 1,000 years ago when the Ho'okam lived in the Phoenix Basin. And so I'm saying, oh, well, you can see these cycles. There was a civilization here that rose and then fell. There's a civilization here again that will rise, or that is rising, and, you know, will again fall. That's what civilizations do. And we see this as being permanent. We look at what's around us and say, well, of course this is going to last. But then you look back through history and nothing lasts. It changes. The phoenix that was there 50 years ago doesn't exist anymore. If those people came back and looked at it, they would be shocked. If you come back in 100 years, you know, maybe it will be a mega city. Maybe it will have just grown beyond all boundaries. And I see that as an end, too, just to say, oh, well, what was here before has been destroyed. And it's been covered up by a mega city.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating, and our friends over at the Santa Fe Institute are studying this and continually letting us know about it, which is that cities themselves tend not to die. They're continually transforming,
right,
and kind of dying back and then burgeoning again, but they outlast countries,
yeah,
they outlast companies, they outlast, you know, civilizations.
Yeah, and that's why I look at Phoenix and say, well, it in a way it never ended here. The ethnic background has changed. The kind of civilization has changed, but they're still growing the same plants. The Ho'okam were growing cotton and corn. You know, cotton was their major crop. The major crop right now in Phoenix is cotton.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed, and the same canals that the Ho'okam dug, the same lines are being used by modern canals. So it's as if the city just exists. It exists beyond time.
Yeah.
If you come back in 10,000 years, there will be a city there. There will be a settlement because the Salt River and the Gila River come down into the desert. And you know, wherever there's water in the desert, there's going to be human stuff happening. And especially a subtropic desert like the Sonoran, where you have just an incredible growing season, wherever you have water, there's going to be a settlement. So there will always be a phoenix there.
Wherever you have water being a big question.
Right. And you know, in a way, there will always be water there, but will there be water for 4 million people?
200,000.
Yeah, yeah. The Ho'okam system was probably around 10,000 people. And we've come in with a new infrastructure that can accommodate 4 million people. With the Central Arizona Project and the Salt River Project. But I talk to people in Phoenix who are saying, well, we can't fall like the Ho'okam did because we're so much bigger. We have such a big infrastructure now. Our safety net's bigger. And I say, well, yeah, the safety net's bigger, but our numbers are much bigger. So it's this, in a way, it's the same. Ho'okam had 10,000 and this small infrastructure, and they fell. Greater Phoenix has 4 million or so, and this giant infrastructure, it can fall too.
Well, and you have a wonderful quote from The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was written several hundred years ago, about, I can't remember the exact quote, but basically the gigantic fabric that was Rome weighing down so heavily that it broke, over the course of centuries, broke the empire.
Yeah, it couldn't support itself anymore. And I think the key there is it's over the course of centuries. That there are some scholars who say Rome never fell. It just kept changing. Because you go to Rome now,
it's still there.
It's not gone.
And it's such a layered city.
Right. Right, and that's what this book looks at, is the layers, is just all the layers of falling that have happened before. And my argument is that cities don't tend to just fall all of a sudden. Civilizations don't just tip over the edge and the next day they're gone. It takes centuries, to the point where you would never even know. If you went to the Mayan system, you know, at its height, the classic Mayan system, 800 years ago, 900 years ago, and if you were there during the fall, and you would have said, "Hey, how is it being in the collapse of civilization?" Most people at the time probably would have said, "What are you talking
about?
Yeah, that city's burning over there. Well, they're always like, we knew they were going to burn anyway. And this city over here is rising. It's like I said, it's more of a mosaic than it is a moment."
505-428-1393. Five books are gone, five books remain. We're almost halfway toward our $1,200 goal for this morning, and we've only got 12 minutes left till the top of the hour. So please call right now if you like this show, 505-428-1393. We're going to give you a minute right now before we go back to the conversation to call and make a pledge to KSFR, 505-428-1393. Because this book is, I don't care what anybody says, you just should, it's something you can curl up on the couch by the fire this winter and read. You can give it away as a Christmas present because it's just so vividly written. You feel like you're there with Craig Childs.
Yeah, and it's, I designed it to be, you know, a beautiful book. I really wanted to give the sense of the beauty of the planet we live on now. I don't come away with a negative feeling. I'm a fairly optimistic person, and I look for resilience. I look for where things work out. I know I'm looking at some very dark and destructive subjects, but I'm coming away just saying, hey, it's going to be okay. You do have to fight for this. You know, you can't just let it go. You can't just keep burning fossil fuels to the end without finding some other way of shouldering up the things that you like about the world. You know, you have to work at this, but it is just a beautiful world. We live at a time that's unparalleled. You know, the last 10,000 years have been just the garden time on Earth. We look at this moment and we say, oh, this must be what the Earth is like. And I'm looking at it in a geologic context going, what we live in right now represents like 10% of the environments that have existed for the last few million years. This is an unusual time. You know, if you had been here 20,000 years ago, it was much drier, much colder. There were giant animals all over the place. It was not a safe place for skinny little bipeds like us.
And we were running around hunting and gathering.
It was a pretty marginal time. And we have come in, you know, there's a reason civilization rose up during the Holocene, during the last 10,000 years, because this is just an awesome time on Earth. This is, you know, just warm, moist. Everything's good.
Right.
And my argument is, you want to keep it this way. You don't want to push it into one of these other equilibriums that isn't, you know, these other ones are not so friendly, you know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, as you said before, human beings have this awesome power because of our numbers and because of burning things, because of burning fossil fuels, and because of all the minerals that we've taken out of the earth and all the different things. Basically overpopulation, climate change, resource depletion, changing of the atmosphere. We have the potential and now we're realizing this power to change the earth as if we were a comet, you know?
Right.
As if we were a big, huge, gigantic natural disaster. Do we also have the equal power to solve the problems?
Oh yeah. And I'm looking all around and seeing that, if we were just destructive, if we just looked at what we're doing right now that destroys habitats, alters chemistry, if that's all that was happening, it would be over. There are a lot of forces working in the opposite direction. There are a lot of forces toward maintaining ecosystems, keeping water going into drainages rather than pulling it all out for some other location. You know, we are really working hard to keep the destruction from happening. So they're both happening, but you have to look at the creative part of what we do too, that we are actually preserving a lot of land. And yeah, the loss is tremendous right now, but if we were not preserving what we are, the loss would be, you know, tenfold.
Right. And I think that's such an important thing to remember, because one thing I've noticed is that public radio listeners tend to think, oh, we people who are trying to make the earth a better place and try to save ourselves from the destruction are a tiny minority and we're powerless. And in fact, that's not really true.
No, it's not true at all, because if that was true, this would look very different. Things would not look as nice as they do. And it's just that I think that the people who are fighting the fight for creation, you know, for things to be good, they are not as vocal. They're working hard fighting the fight. They're putting their weight into it wherever they can. And so, you know, we're not alone. If we were alone,
it'd be game over.
Yeah, it'd be game over.
428-1393 is the number. 428-1393. We've got one book left.
Right.
Yay, we've gotten 9 books out into the hands of our wonderful listeners. 1 book left, and we can still make it to our $1,200 goal by the top of the hour, which is in a few minutes. I think Mary Lynn has a report from the control room.
I do, and the phones are ringing right now as I speak. We have several thank yous.
Good.
Claire Clay.
Thank you.
Karen Tischer.
Yay.
Richard Besser.
Wonderful.
Stuart McCall.
Thank you.
Catherine Drawn.
Yes.
Judith Golly.
Wow.
And Dean Williamson.
All right. Keep going, ladies and gentlemen. 428-1393. And give a contribution. And if there's no books left, you know, you can go buy the book. You can order the book. You can go down to Collected Works Bookstore and get a copy of the book, or to any of the local bookstores. And easy enough to get, but you can get that one book that's left. 428-1393, 428-1393, and get a copy of the book. Now, you were talking, Craig Childs, a moment ago. We're talking about Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. You were talking about, oh, and also thank you to David Brown, who called. I just got that message, too. you were talking about infrastructure, and one of the things that I think we take for granted, although even if we don't, we still don't know that much about it. I mean, I often, in the morning, turn on the water in the bathroom faucet and go, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not to be taken for granted.
No, it isn't. It takes so much work on so many levels. I mean, the reason the water is coming out of the faucet is because, you know, 50 years ago, people made decisions about water rights. People thought ahead. The infrastructure was laid down and then maintained. And, you know, so much work goes into making a civilization happen that we don't think about. We just go, oh, great, we got roads, we got, you know, we got parking lots, we got power, we got telephone. But that all, civilization is a tremendous amount of work.
And there is a life cycle to every piece of infrastructure. And one of the things that's very interesting about this time is that a lot of the infrastructure that we have in big cities, particularly back east, but also out here, I mean, was put in the 19th century, the early to mid 20th century, and they're not going to last forever. And in fact, they're all kind of coming to the end of their expected life cycle.
Yeah, if one thing I project out in this book is I'm looking at, you know, what was the technique for the water infrastructure on the East Coast in the late 1800s and then and early 1900s? And you know, it's gotten less and less substantial over time. That we're actually using things that decay more quickly now. And if you put all the numbers together, from the 19th century to now, the decay leads to right around now that things start breaking down.
Expiration date.
Right. We are at the expiration date for a lot of bridges, for water infrastructure, and I don't remember the numbers, but they're in this book of the water main, the increasing number of water mains that are breaking around the country, and just the decay of general infrastructure. And that's where I'm saying, hey, you know, this is normal, it's fine, but boy, if things go downhill, they could go downhill fast. If we don't have the funding to repair our infrastructure or to keep things up, then the collapse, you know, could be quite noticeable over a period of years.
428-1393 is the number. 428-1393. We are pushing $900 right now. We'd like to get to $1,200 before the, well, in the next, well, by the end of the news, by the end of the 9 o'clock news. So we are just about out of time. But
well, this is part of the infrastructure.
Yeah,
here.
The public radio is part of
what holds this whole thing together. And this is one of those rare opportunities where you could just slap down some cash and send it straight into the infrastructure and support an operating piece of your world.
It's so true. Thank you for saying that. I like to think of it that way, because information and communication and being able to talk to each other and to think with each other is part of what keeps the infrastructure up and what keeps our basically communities functioning. It's like a kind of vascular system. It's like the mental blood supply of our community.
Yeah, and these things don't just appear. They take a lot of effort.
There's much more to talk about in this book, Apocalyptic Planet, but it's just about time to go. The book is called Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, and you will be speaking tonight as part of the Southwest Seminars Lecture Series. That's at 6 o'clock at the Hotel Santa Fe, which is right on the corner of Cerrillos and Paseo here in Santa Fe, and it's co-sponsored by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, which is at nmelc.org, and they have a whole series on Monday night, so you can go for more information to their website. But this is a wonderful opportunity for people to go out and see you.
I'll be there. I'll have images from a lot of these locations and stories from the field.
Did you take pictures?
Oh, yeah. I have video clips and a lot of spectacular views of you know, the Greenland ice sheet and the Atacama Desert in South America. We're gonna have a good journey tonight.
When you're out there, if you're with a camera and you're writing,
there's a lot going on.
You're basically trying to live, breathe, observe, and document at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like I'm documenting a moment on the earth. In a way, this book is saying, well, this is what it looked like now. In a way, I wrote this book for 100 years from now, so that there will be a reference to what the planet was like.
428-1393, Craig Childs, author of the book Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me over here.
And you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. It's just about time to go, but let's see. I think we are very close to our goal. We'll find out by the end of the 9 o'clock news. 428-1393. Please make a contribution to KSFR. Please make a contribution to this program. It is part of the infrastructure. Every dollar counts. Every ring counts. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for contributing. Stay tuned for the news. Hasta la vista.